Like a backstage pass to the world of fly fishing travel, this is Waypoints, the podcast of destination angling. News and events, helpful travel tips, destination profiles, great stories, and expert advice from some of the most seasoned and experienced names in fishing travel. Waypoints is brought to you by Yellow Dog Fly Fishing Adventures, the industry's number one specialty travel company for the very best insider knowledge, logistical support, and trip preparation. Freshwater or saltwater, international or domestic, Yellow Dog has you covered for your next fishing adventure. And now, your Waypoints host, Yellow Dog founder and director, Jim Klug.
Christmas Island, the world's largest coral atoll, has a legendary reputation as one of the most productive destinations in the world for saltwater flats fishing, especially when it comes to massive numbers of bonefish. This was one of the first established and certainly exotic saltwater fisheries for the traveling fly fishermen. And over the past 50 years, many of our sport's bonefish techniques, flat strategies, and bonefish fly patterns have originated on the iconic flats of the atoll. Also known as Kiritimati, Christmas is an immense coral outcropping located in the northern Line Islands of the country of Kiribati. Kiribati is a tiny republic in the West Central Pacific, a country made up of 33 main atolls and islands, only 20 of which are inhabited. Christmas itself has the greatest land area of any atoll in the world, over 150 square miles, with a large inner lagoon of roughly the same size. The enormous flat system that surrounds this landmass and encompasses the inner lagoon is home to countless numbers of bonefish, several species of trevally, milkfish, triggerfish, and more. Vast, hard sand flats allow anglers to wade fish almost 100% of the time, with super consistent numbers of bonefish and constant opportunities and shots over the course of a standard week. While the majority of the island's bonefish average 2 to 3 pounds, larger fish are, of course, a possibility. And when it comes to diversity of species, anglers can also target giant trevally, golden trevally, triggers, and milkfish in the shallow waters, with blue water possibilities for tuna, sailfish, marlin, wahoo, and more. Because of the atoll's proximity to the equator, Christmas typically delivers stable weather and ideal fishing conditions on a year-round basis. As for a quick history of the atoll, it was first sighted on Christmas Eve in 1777 by the English navigator Captain James Cook, which is how the atoll obviously got its name. The island was originally named by the Brits, officially claimed by the United States in 1856, and later incorporated by Great Britain in 1919. Over the years, actual ownership of the atoll was at times confusing and murky, largely in dispute until 1979, when Kiritimati became a part of the independent Republic of Kiribati. During World War II, Christmas Island played a significant role for Allied forces, who used the large atoll as an important refueling station for military aircraft en route from Hawaii to the South Pacific. Post-World War II, the atoll was an operations base for nuclear weapons testing by both the Brits and the U.S. The U.K. conducted its first hydrogen bomb tests in early 1957, using Christmas Island as the operation's main base. In late 1957, the first H-bomb was actually detonated over the southeastern tip of the atoll, with additional nuclear testing on and around the atoll conducted by the U.S. until 1962. By the late 1970s, a U.S. team had determined there was no measurable radioactivity remaining on Christmas Island, announcing that the island was, once again, safe for visitors. This, of course, begs the question, what about the local residents who had remained on the atoll the entire time? In 1981, an air link with the outside world was started by Air Tongariro, which at the time was Kiribati's national carrier. And while these weekly flights made Christmas accessible for travelers and anglers alike, the atoll remained largely unknown until it was introduced to a larger world audience in a December 1983 Sports Illustrated article titled "Greetings from Christmas." In this feature piece, the author wrote about the incredible numbers of bonefish and trevally found on the expansive flats of the atoll, something that immediately piqued the interest of anglers from throughout the world. From that point on, Christmas became a hot destination, and ever since, anglers have continued to make the journey to what is still one of the most remote fisheries on the planet. Getting to Christmas Island still feels like an adventure in itself. Not to be confused with the other Christmas Island near Australia, the Angler's Christmas Island is located almost exactly in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. As such, there is only one flight per week from the United States. In this episode of Waypoints, we're talking about how Christmas Island has, until only recently, been completely closed and shut down for more than 3 years. The country of Kiribati, which of course includes Christmas, was among the first countries to lock things down in the winter of 2020 when COVID was first becoming an issue. And since that time, until May of 2023, the country has remained completely shut off, closed to all visitors and anglers longer than any other international fishing destination. Which is why my first guest today is angler Tim Rote. Now, Tim is not a fly fishing industry professional. He's not a guide, a lodge owner, or a Yellow Dog program director. Instead, in a first for a Waypoints episode, he's a regular client, an angler who quite simply loves to fish and travel. The main reason that we're talking with Tim today is that he was recently a part of the first group of anglers to return to Christmas Island after more than 3 years and 1 month of the atoll being completely closed. Tim was on the very first flight back to the island, and he returned only a couple of days ago with a full report on what he found during his week on the atoll. Tim is the co-founder and owner of Bozeman, Montana-based Dovetail Construction, a company that is routinely recognized as one of the best custom home builders in the state. He's traveled all over the world, and he loves to fish far off waters and experience new destinations just as much as he loves to fish his home waters in Montana. So, Tim, welcome to Waypoints and welcome home from your recent trip to Christmas Island.
Why, thank you, Jim.
It's a long, long way to go, and you're back.
Yeah.
Well, I know that our listeners are anxious to hear about the current situation on Christmas Island, what you found fishing-wise and at the lodge, but first, I want to get some background on yourself and your past angling pursuits. You made your first trip to Christmas Island back in 2017, correct?
Yeah.
That was your first time to the island,
it
the atoll.
For my 50th birthday, 2 weeks.
Well, you must have loved it because you decided to book a return trip only a few years later.
Yeah, it was spectacular.
Well, give us a quick rundown of some of the other international destinations aside from Christmas that you fished over the years, maybe some of your favorite destinations.
Sure. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I kind of hope that I'll have the fame of Lefty Cray and Diana Rudolph and some of the other greats. I heard a podcast by Waypoints with Andy Mills. So shout out to all the wonderful fishermen out there and women.
And we're excited to have you.
This well, thanks. Yeah, it's an honor. I've been blessed to travel to various destinations, and many of them, the majority with the help of Yellow Dog, Belize multiple times throughout the country, out on the atolls as well as inland and on the jungle side. We've fished in Mexico, Panama, Honduras, Hawaii. Those are a few that come to mind.
Seychelles?
Not yet.
Oh, okay.
But on this trip, I was bugging a well-heeled guy from Texas to rent a G6 and make sure I get on the plane with him.
That's a good ticket.
Yeah. We'll see if that comes together, Jerry and Joel.
Well, I love it. Well, tell me, Tim, what was it that originally drew you to Christmas Island back in 2017? You said it was your 50th birthday, but what was it that you kind of had heard about Christmas Island that led you to book that initial trip and took you there the first time?
Yeah, the first time I wasn't as focused as a fly fisherman as I am now, but I had heard about it in the mid to late 90s. I was working in the Seattle area, and some regulars that had been going down there for over a decade actually had mentioned it to me. And I really wasn't into the salt at that point yet. And then fast forward to 49th year of my life, and we built a house for a wonderful couple in Paradise Valley, Diana Rudolph and Jerry Seam. And they invited me to dinner at their place, and Jerry used to design sage fly rods. And he had all of the sage reps from around the world at their house for dinner. And while I was there, I'm like, okay, this is perfect. I've got to ask these guys, where would they go, you know, on a builder's budget, not the Seychelles necessarily, but someplace cool for saltwater fishing. And this great guy from Australia named Peter Morse, whom I understand is the Lefty Cray of Australia, he said something the effect of, I know where you need to go, mate, to Christmas Island. And when you go, go for 2 weeks. And don't forget the triggers. And so that's what got me to Christmas Island. And then you guys helped me out.
Well, that's pretty solid advice for Peter. He's dead right about that. And the 2 weeks is a great way to do it as well. What, after that first trip in 2017, Tim, were kind of your takeaways from that experience? What did you love about the fishery and your first trip over there?
Well, I stayed at the villages, which was also Peter's advice. And the one-on-one guiding was fantastic. To be right on the water, to be able to load out and go was really cool. The diversity of the fishery, to see, you know, huge manta rays as well as jeets and, you know, the triggers and the bones. And my wife and I actually did do some scuba diving. They were offering scuba diving at that time. This last trip, they're not set up for it yet. And that was second to none as far as diving that I've done around the world.
Nice. Well, you loved it. You got back. We were dealing with the pandemic, but then countries started to reopen, you know, Mexico, Belize, the Bahamas, kind of the standards. At that point, you had been talking with the team at Yellow Dog about getting back to Christmas Island, and you had kind of expressed your desire that you said, you know, when it reopens, I want to be one of the first ones back over there. I want to be on that first plane back to Christmas. And that sounded simple enough, right? We were like, yeah, no problem. But this, of course, proved to be a little more complicated than we all expected, as the Kiribati government announced numerous different opening dates for like a year and a half. They would announce a date. We'd get right up to that date. People would have tickets bought, everything planned out, logistics for staying in Hawaii en route to get to Christmas Island. And then sometimes a week or 2 weeks out, the government would announce yet another delay. And this happened multiple times. And the whole goal of being first in started to get a little bit more murky and a little more complicated.
Yeah, indeed it did. But, you know, we rolled with it. I'm fortunate to have a sister, Betsy, and my brother-in-law, Matt, that live in Oahu. So I was extremely flexible to roll with the punches. And I stayed in touch with your travel agent over in Hawaii, Vanessa.
Yeah.
And she has a connection with Fiji Airlines, which is the airlines that flies from Honolulu to Kiribati each week. And so it was constant, you know, you guys at Yellow Dog as well as Vanessa kind of giving me the updates on what was going on. And it was part of the fun factor, quite frankly.
Yeah, it almost, you know, it got frustrating, I think, for a lot of anglers, but it, you know, there came a point where it almost, like, as you said, became kind of hilarious, because it's like, here we go again. You know, it's going to open. It's going to open. Oh, no, it's not. Then they'd pull back and then another opening date. And this happened multiple times. Pretty soon we're all just kind of shaking our head. We had a pool going in the office where everybody wrote up, you know, their guest date for the opening. And I don't think anybody won, because, you know, after 3 years, I think we all just gave up. But it got down to it in April of this year, in April of 2023, Fiji Airways, which, as you just mentioned, is the way you get to Christmas Island. In fact, it's the only way to get to Christmas Island. You can only get there by airplane. And there is one flight once a week. Mm-hmm. It's the one you do not want to miss. No. But Fiji announced that flights would resume on May 2nd. And at this point, we're like, okay, this is going to happen. This became the new target date and things were looking good. I think at that time the lodge was full, but we were able to finagle a rod spot for you with a few weeks out. And here you are, you're booked, and it is looking to be the first opening week on May 2nd. So you fly to Honolulu, you spend the night, you head to the airport early Tuesday morning on May 2nd to check in for that once a week flight on Fiji Airways. And this is, again, over 3 years, nothing's flown, hasn't happened. The first Fiji Air flight, tell us about the check-in experience and what that was like when you got to the airport. Who was there? What was the mood? What was the atmosphere like?
Yeah, there was a lot of like rumblings that Hawaiian Airlines may handle the check-in for Fiji, that they can be really strict on weight limitations and quantity of bags and things like that. But it panned out that when I arrived with my sister helping me with the bags, because I was pivoting like, okay, if I have to shift 10 pounds from this one into that one, I'm going to do that. And, you know, the whole rigmarole. Mood was great. You could definitely tell there were, you know, probably, I'm guessing there was maybe 30 to 40 total fishermen on that flight. And Fiji Airlines checked us in. There wasn't any problem or real, you know, challenges with the quantity of bags or the weight or whatever. And I remember in the lobby up near the gate, there was either a destroyer or a aircraft battle group offshore of Pearl Harbor. And it was surreal because I, from 2017, I knew where I was heading and how primitive and small that airport is. It's basically a little wood shack. And I'm watching F-35s come into Honolulu International, you know, to roll over to Pearl. And I took a little video of those F-35s and, you know, they're coming in, they're going out. I'm like, holy cow, this is a different world than where I'm going.
Very different.
But everybody was pumped. You know, we're just that thrill of what always kept me in the game and patient and cool about it was, what is this place going to be like? What are the people going to be like? And we were all just, you know, pins and needles.
Well, when you fly out, and this is sometimes confusing for people, you fly out of Honolulu on a Tuesday. It's about a 4-hour flight, give or take. But you arrive on Christmas Island on a Wednesday because, of course, you cross the international dateline. And same way, at the end of your week, you fly out from Christmas on a Wednesday and you arrive back on a Tuesday. So it's always a little bit confusing. But again, it's that one flight a week. That's the only way to get there. What did you have to deal with on COVID protocols? And I ask this because, you know, most of the world has moved on by this point, right? Mm-hmm. There's very few travel restrictions anywhere. But for Kiribati and on Christmas Island, COVID was kind of still a concern as they're opening up here. So did you have to deal with any requirements or jump through any hoops on this?
Yeah, the requirement going in was that you had to have an up-to-date vaccination card ready to go. And honestly, I don't think anybody really even looked at it. We were all prepared with them. Mm-hmm. And nobody, you know, that was kind of a bit of a conversation. I was like, wow, they didn't really even look into the status of our COVID vaccinations. I think they were just thrilled to get us on a plane and get back there.
Well, you board the plane, they close the door, the plane starts taxiing, it lifts off from Honolulu. As you said, there's probably 40 anglers on the flight, give or take. What was the mood like? I mean, was it kind of celebratory? Were people apprehensive? Or, you know, what was it like on that 4-hour flight?
Well, certainly those really ugly Fiji Airlines stewardesses were part of it. the mood was, you know, it was not a celebratory mood, but you could just tell there was a great energy about the plane. There was a professional surfer going down to Fiji beyond, and I remember he and his girlfriend saying something to me like, I think we're making a mistake. They're staying there a month for professional surfing. And they're like, I think we're going to the wrong place. We should be getting off with these guys. So, you know,
the mood was happy.
Yeah, it was.
And so at this point, you know, you're airborne. You realize that after all these delays and all this time and the ups and downs, it's finally happening. You have 4 hours until arrival. What were your expectations at this point? What were you thinking as you were about to land on Christmas?
Boy, I had two thoughts. One was going to be massive apprehension amongst the locals. I had lived in Hawaii for over 4 years starting my career. And I kind of thought, okay, we may not be received with open arms. There could be a great deal of, you know, concern about bringing in COVID or whatever. And then on the flip side, I thought, well, maybe we'll really be welcome back because they've been isolated for 3 years. So that was kind of my my thoughts as far as what we were going to fly into.
So pretty normal flight, no delays. The plane touches down on Christmas Island, as you said a moment ago, Cassidy International Airport is what it's called. And that sounds much grander than it is. It's a long strip left over from World War II with basically like a wooden shack, as you talked about. It's a tiny, tiny little terminal. The plane taxis up. There's no, you know, jet gates or anything at this terminal. They just put down the stairs. You walk off the plane. What were you met with?
Well, upon a final approach, I was on a window seat, and I was videoing on the way in, and got a great look at the lagoon and all the flats, which is just super expansive. And then as we came in on final approach, I noticed that they had pulled their two old fire engines out, and they both had the lights going, like little individual red lights on top of each fire truck. So that kind of gave me the impression, okay, they're either freaked out that the plane may crash, or or this is maybe something of fanfare upon, you know, taxiing over to the international airport terminal. And then we got in, went through the room for, you know, immigration, and you could hear the music outside of the walls. And as each angler would leave, you'd get a glimpse of what's going on out there. And there was a beautiful woman from Kiribati putting headdresses on each of the people that were coming off of the plane. And there was singing and music and hula. It was absolutely spectacular.
And
something that
there.
We kept telling during the week, how special that was to us. We relayed that to the staff and to the guides that, you know, we didn't know what to expect. And are you happy to have us back? And they were, you know, thank you very much for that. And they loved hearing that we appreciated that.
That's so cool. So the whole community came out to welcome that first plane load of anglers back to the
Indeed.
Island.
Indeed. Like out in the outskirts of the airport, there were little kids with their parents and just watching that plane. You know, for some of those kids, that's the first plane they've ever seen.
Yeah. For the young ones, for sure. Yeah. It's been a while.
Right.
Yeah. And they were definitely excited to have anglers back on the atoll.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. So you load up the trucks at the airport. You make the drive over to the villages, which is where you were staying for the week. The villages is one of basically five fishing operations and lodges on the atoll. Now, the villages, like all of them, have been closed for more than 3 years at this point. What was your immediate impression when you arrived at the lodge, kind of walked onto the grounds?
Driving there, I was making a comment. Basically, I was one of the last to get my poop in a group to get onto the truck. And one guy and I drove with the head guide, Bob, and his counterpart back to the lodge. And I was making a comment to Bob. I was like, place looks great. I mean, things were kept up well. People were waving to us. We were waving back to them on the way to the lodge. So the community was happy, not just those spectators that were at the airport. Lodge was in great shape. Very similar greeting. You could tell that the staff was re-familiarizing themselves with how to greet the sports and kind of line us out on what to expect. And, you know, they were just kind of getting back into the groove, and it was a really cool thing to watch. But it was in good shape, really good shape.
That's so good to hear. And you guys had a full lodge for the week. You had like 18 anglers.
Yep, indeed.
And how were the facilities when you arrived? What did you find with the, you know, talked a little bit about the staff, but the rooms, you know, the AC, you know, the water filtration, kind of the overall lodge situation after this closure.
Yeah. Everything worked. The refrigeration worked. The AC units were working. Last night we were there, the AC units didn't work. It was a cool night with, nice trade winds. So it wasn't unpleasant. So that all, the AC for the whole week worked. The boiler wasn't working. So, you know, I was kind of laughing at it, being from Montana, who needs hot water in a hot environment, right? So I was trying to get the showers as cold as they could to cool off. And some guys were like, yeah, I didn't have any hot water. Did you? No, I'm trying to stay away from it. The water purification system, which is super important because the water table there is extremely shallow and it's not sanitary. So you need to be very careful with not inadvertently brushing your teeth with the tap water. Use the bottled water, the pitchers that they leave in your room. So nobody for that entire week, and I was the youngest on that group, at 56 years old, nobody got sick, which is, you know, you can get the stomach flu and the poops.
Yeah. Not uncommon on Christmas Island.
Right. I heard about a trip with you guys years ago.
We've had some adventures over the years on Christmas. You know, as you said, it's a place you always want to bring lots of Imodium and other things, as well as, you know, some of your own snacks and food like that. But speaking of which, how was the food? You know, and I say that, preface that with, Christmas Island has always been a great place for anglers. It is more of kind of an off the grid, somewhat rugged destination. It's very comfortable as far as the accommodations. Not known for its phenomenal cuisine, I guess I would is a way I would put it. But it's always kind of spotty with the food. What did you find on this trip?
Food was great. You know, to her credit, my wife braved the Spartan accommodations with me in 2017, and she wished me well going back because she knew there wasn't scuba this time. And I thank you, dear. but the food was good. They, you know, little minor things like they couldn't find non-refrigerated eggs. So for breakfast, we had like pancakes and bacon, which was perfectly fine. Lobster tails and chicken, little beef stew, rice. They'd catch wahoo or ono and, you know, cook that at night as well. And then the next morning when you make your sandwiches, there would be wonderful fish to make a tuna fish sandwich with wahoo, which was pretty special.
And no shortage of seafood. That's one thing they always get right.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, you were saying the staff was excited to have you back, the locals in general. Describe for those who have not been to Christmas Island, kind of what the local inhabitants, the people of Christmas are like. How would you kind of describe the locals?
For the most part, I would say they're relatively quiet. There's a bit of a language barrier, but they're very hospitable. They like to laugh. Some of the folks that are a little better with their English enjoy telling jokes. The guides are super helpful. There's a, you know, not to confuse Hawaii with Kiribati, but there is certainly an aloha spirit in Christmas Island.
Well, the inhabitants of Christmas Island are Micronesian. And it's interesting because English is the official language of the country, but as you were saying, a lot of the locals speak Gilbertese or iKiribati, I think they call it. So there's a little bit of a language barrier, but enough people speak English where it makes it pretty easy for the most part. Yeah. And it's interesting because the island's population, if you go back to the late 80s, and there were only a couple thousand people living on the atoll, pre-pandemic, they were up to about 8,000 on that atoll. And I don't know if those numbers have changed since then or if anyone left during the pandemic. But more people than you think on that island.
Yeah, for sure. Those statistics that you read at the beginning of Waypoints, that was an education for me.
Well, it's an interesting place. A lot of history on the atoll. Indeed. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about the big topic that most of our listeners are waiting for. And that, of course, is how was the fishing? And we're going to discuss that right after we take this quick break to hear from one of our sponsors. We'll be right back. This is Jim Klug, host of the Waypoints podcast. As an experienced traveler, I know choosing the right equipment is everything, especially when I'm headed to remote or far-off destinations. For more than 20 years, Fishpond USA has pioneered gear design specific to anglers, with craftsmanship, sustainable fabrics, and functionality derived from decades of experience traveling and fishing the world. From Fishpond's submersible duffels and technical fishing packs, to fly boxes and thoughtfully designed luggage, the systems that carry our gear make a real difference in how our long days on the water and our nights in far-off places are remembered. Visit fishpondusa.com to take a look at some of my favorite gear. And when you take the road less traveled, make sure you travel with Fishpond. We're back with angler Tim Rode and his recent trip report from the opening week on Christmas Island after a closure of more than 3 years. He was on the first plane back. So, Tim, all this time of the fishery being closed, you've arrived now on the atoll, you've made the trip, they've gotten you there, expectations are high, you head out for day one of your fishing week. Tell us a little bit about that. What did the fishery look like, and what were your first impressions as soon as you got on the water?
Well, one of the concerns that we shared was, okay, there's the accommodations, there's the food, the water purification, check, check, check. How are the boats? Because you got to get on the boat to get out to the flats. So as we were motoring out, our boat sounded great, got going, moved out, got around London, and all of a sudden it motor sounded a little different, and you heard poof and little smoke emanating from the top of the motor house. So we popped off on a flat, fished there for a while as they retrieved another motor, got us underway, and we're out to the land of the promised land. And the flats look great, you know. It's just such a spectacularly beautiful spot to watch the clouds roll over and the light change on the water and the color of the water change. And we were just beside ourselves going out there. But the flats were just as I had remembered them to be.
And, you know, one of the concerns that I had heard from a couple of people over this 3 year plus closure was, well, gosh, you know, are they gill netting? Are they eating the bonefish? Is it going to take a toll on the numbers of fish? We were assured from our contacts on the island, the guides we were keeping in touch with, the lodge managers, that was not the case at all, that the resource was being well protected. The bonefish were being looked after. Nobody was doing any gill netting. Is that kind of what you found when you got there?
Yeah. And they were hand lining offshore. So they refer to it as the blue water. You know, so, which is an option. You can go out in the blue water as well as the flats, but we were all focused on the lagoon and the flats. So yes, I would concur that they ate primarily tuna and milkfish that were harvested out in the blue water. That's the, you know, so as back to the lagoon, the numbers of I didn't really focus on the bonefish. I'm a GT freak and triggers. Peter, I did not forget about the triggers. And the bone numbers, there were certain guys there that were really focused on the bones because that is just one of the world's best bone fisheries, right? And they, to a person, said they felt the numbers of bones were better than ever before. And that the size of the bones had increased. I think they were thrown around 30% bigger.
Well, and it was often the case coming out of COVID with a lot of these closures in different destinations. It's so amazing that when you rest a fishery and you, by and large, eliminate, you know, all, if not a good portion of the pressure, that even a fairly modest number of anglers on a weekly basis can put on a fishery, you basically just eliminate that, multiply it by a year, 2 years, in this case, 3 years, the behavior of the fish is amazing. Just how, you know, little pressure can change that, and certainly in an angler's advantage. So I have to imagine that for those guys during your week that were out every day chasing bones, they were finding some pretty willing fish.
Yeah. And the GTs were what I would say. I'd almost say that the GT numbers were similar to what I saw in the past. But they were aggressive. They were, you know, you get a fly out there and they were going to crush it.
Without hesitation.
Yeah. I had a wonderful popper pattern, as well as a brush flies, various ones that I've bought here at Bozeman at Yellow Dog. And the poppers that I brought down were tied by a guy, Taylor Beard. Thank you, Taylor, for your poppers, because they wouldn't let me take your popper patterns off down there. So yeah, they wouldn't let me take that popper off. For those of you that want to try to find a Taylor Beard tie, you could go to Instagram, which is hashtag 406_flies. That's my one shameless plug.
Now he's going to get blown up after this.
Don't. So, he works for me and I really, really, really need him. And thank you to my guys that let me do these trips like this. It means the world to me.
Well, one thing I thought that was worth mentioning again is that you talked about the transportation to and from the flats each day from the lodge. Now, usually this involves one of two things. You either hop on a boat right there and you head out to the flats, and the boats at Christmas, you rarely fish out of the boats. They're more of like a taxi where, you know, the anglers along with the guides are shuttled from flat to flat. Then you hop out, you'll wade your way across, you know, an expansive flat from one side to the other. The guide will wave, the boat will come back over, pick you up and take you to the next one. Pretty common on Christmas. Mm-hmm. The other way is a truck ride where you pile into the back of an old like deuce and a half type truck, and it takes you to different areas of the atoll where you then get out, maybe walk the beach or wade into certain areas. And of course, you know, the story of the engine that conked out on your first morning. Well, I think people were kind of expecting that, you know, these trucks and boats, maybe they haven't been run a lot these last 3 years. Did you have any other problems other than that first morning, or what was your general takeaway on kind of the condition of the equipment, the trucks and the boats?
Yeah. We didn't do any truck fishing. There's a spot called the Huff Dam that can be accessed by truck. We were there during a full moon, so that spring tide kind of prevented us from getting out to that area. And the tidal influences makes it very difficult for boats to access that, because you can get stuck back there during a low tide and have to wait. And we didn't get down to the Korean wreck for largely the same reason, because that's kind of coastal fishing, and that spring tide just kind of comes in quickly and eliminates your fishing opportunities. So we didn't do the trucks. The boats, they were super prompt on getting things straightened away with the boats. And yeah, they had some challenges with the motors, but they got after it.
And you mentioned the Korean wreck. For those that haven't been to Christmas Island, this is a pretty famous area kind of on the far side of the atoll from most of where the lodges are. Takes a long drive to get there, but pretty spectacular beach that opened up into this massive expanse of flats that kind of a legendary fishing area for sure. And oftentimes visited at least once during the week when you're there.
And that's why I need to go back a third time, Jim, is because I've never been to the Korean wreck yet.
Well, you definitely need to go back a third time then.
I'll be calling.
Well, you mentioned a second ago tides. Now, you guys were there during a spring tide. In fact, what we call a king spring tide. You had the full moon dead in the middle of your week. I think it was on May 5th. You were there the 2nd through the 9th. So you had big water, big pushes. We've actually dedicated entire episodes of Waypoints to just talking about tides, the pros and cons of spring tides versus the pros and cons of neap tides. But you were there during a spring, big spring. Oftentimes for bonefish, that can be a little disruptive because with the big pushes and the big, you know, ebbs and flows from the highest highs to the lowest lows, you get pushed around a little bit as a wading angler. If you're on foot, those tides are coming up fast. They're dropping fast. The fish are really getting pushed around. That's often the case with bonefish on spring tides. However, and we were talking about the GTs, the giant trevally fishing, GTs typically love big spring tides, and you get a lot better GT action oftentimes. And did you find that was the case this week?
I did. It was surreal. My first day out was the day that I caught my biggest GT. And I caught GTs every day that I was there, with the exception of my last. But I distinctly remember during the peak of that tide that we walked over. I think we were on 9 Mile, and there were literally GTs holding, waiting for the bait fish to be washed off of the flat. They were just staged up. And I mean, literally holding, whereas GTs are known for darting in and out and just crashing stuff. And so anyhow, I saw that one. I didn't hook up on that one, but a couple others had moved in, and that's a
good action.
A great
for the
shot.
Week.
Yeah, it was awesome. And the guides knew those tides, and, you know, and I think they're really kind of figuring out where these jeets have moved to, and, you know, they knew 3 years ago, but they still do. The guides did a great job.
Well, and again, it's just a testament to what a lack of pressure can do, where these fish maybe completely restage or develop new habits or patterns. So, yeah. As you said, it takes a little time to figure that out. Now, again, this was your second trip, Tim. Did you feel this time like you were prepared? Did you have everything you need? Is there anything when you got there, you know, day two, day three, day four, you're like, oh, I can't believe I forgot this, or I wish I would have brought this. Anything that stands out?
No, I was really prepared. Your list of pre-prep stuff is fantastic. You know, I basically followed that Yellow Dog guide on what to pack as well as how much to pack. I think that I can tend to like, okay, well, I'm going to be down there for 6 days and I need, you know, 5 shirts or something. And you go through there and slim that down and whatnot. Brought backup line.
Always a good idea.
Oh yeah. Backup reels, backup rods. I was told at that dinner way back when in 2016 that introduced me to the idea of going there was you're going to blow stuff up. So make sure you pack backup.
Well, yeah. And again, Christmas is an extremely remote place and it's really hard to find things if you happen to forget them. You know, there's no fly shop you can run down the street to. You got to bring everything you need. You got to, you know, have your own backup equipment. Oftentimes other anglers at the lodge can help you out, but you do really want to go through that whole process as you're packing and preparing and making sure you bring everything you're going to need.
Yeah.
No question about it. The rods, reels, we talked about that, extra fly lines, flies. You got to bring everything with you for all the different species. One thing I always bring to Christmas Island is a fair amount of snacks, mm-hmm. which is, you know, energy bars, almonds, jerky, whatever it is. I just like to have that stuff with me because, again, we talked about the food. It can be up and down on certain weeks, but it's always nice to have that stuff out in the boat with you.
Yeah,
for sure. What else stood out that you were really glad that you brought?
I didn't need to use it, but I brought antibiotics, mm-hmm. The ammonium ED that you mentioned. I brought a water filter, so that was super helpful. Just in case the purification system went down, that I'd be able to filter water on my own. And until I established a level of confidence in the water, after that first night, nobody was sick. So I would just, that first day I would filter the water out of the pitcher in the room, and I was glad I brought a water filter.
Yeah. Good advice for sure.
I brought a bunch of boots down there too. Those guides needed boots.
Oh yeah.
Guys let me know that. Yep. So I brought some, I asked my friends to think about if they had an extra pair of flats boots, and they were super appreciative of that.
Oh, I bet the guides love that.
Yeah.
That's key. Again, that's that, you know, 3 year break, you know, they didn't have anything. So
sunglasses, they need those too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're always quick to say, Tim, that Christmas Island is not necessarily for everyone, right? It's not a luxury destination. It's not full of tons of options for non-anglers, unless of course you're a diver or a bird watcher. And that is if the dive operations are actually running. The food and the accommodations can be pretty basic. So again, it's not for everybody, but in your opinion, from someone who's traveled to a lot of other places and experienced a lot of destinations, who should go to Christmas Island? You know, for whom is this destination in this program ideal?
I would say it's not for the faint of heart or really picky people. If, you know, marginal food's going to bug you, don't go. If, you know, sporadic air conditioning possibilities, even though I didn't experience that really, it's going to drive you crazy, don't go. To those of you that want to learn potentially how to fly fish, I don't think you could find a better place to learn how to fish for saltwater species, especially the bonefish, which is often the species that most of us target a first time out on saltwater. So I think it's a great opportunity for those that are wanting to try the salt, that are resilient as far as lodging and accommodations. And then for those that are super interested in fishing for GTs and triggers, you know, I think it's one of the most affordable, if not the most affordable, opportunity to catch giant trevally and trigger fish.
Yeah. And we really haven't talked enough about the triggers, so far. Those this bastards. Episode. They are such an amazing fish.
They and, sure are.
And one of the coolest flat species you can find anywhere on the planet. And Christmas Island is legit when it comes to triggers.
Oh yeah. I caught some big triggers.
They're awesome. And they're a weird, weird little fish, but, they are so much fun to fish for. You're always on foot. You're stalking them. They're very picky, but
spooky
and weird, but they love to eat flies when it's done right.
Yep.
And what a cool fish to catch.
Yeah. They're powerful. Yeah. Pound for pound. They're just a bulldog.
They are. And they're strange little set of teeth that look like a human set of teeth in there.
Keep your fingers clear.
Yes.
They indeed. Will come off.
Yeah. They will take a fingertip off. Like it's nothing.
Yeah.
Well, that's all really good feedback, Tim, and we appreciate you sharing all of this with us. And you've only been back a couple days, so I love the fact that we got you and you were fresh off the return flight so we could get all the latest updates and the impressions after that 3-plus-year closure. So to sum things up, let me ask you this simply. Was it worth the wait?
Oh, absolutely. It was an adventure, you know, to, like I was saying, you didn't know which side of the fence, the experience was going to be super rough from A to Z, or was it going to be, you know, lights out, fantastic experience? And the latter's certainly true. For all the reasons that I mentioned, it was certainly worth the wait.
That's great to hear. And so I take it you would go back again.
Oh yeah. Now I got to get to the Korean wreck.
There you go. Korean wreck. Well, last question, what can we as anglers be doing to help the community? You mentioned bringing over wading boots, sunglasses, all the things that the guides have probably worn out over the last few years and are now without. As they reopen and continue to recover, you know, their economy and the fly fishing industry on Christmas Island, anything we can be doing to help out that community?
That's a great question. And I don't know about what the community necessarily needs. But you know, when I had asked you guys at Yellow Dog, what can I bring? You know, what I used to bring down there was things for the kids, you know, soccer balls and coloring books or little education. My wife's a former teacher. So, we brought things down for the children along with a little candy, which always makes them go crazy. And they're absolutely adorable little kids that swim around those boats when you pull back in late in the day. And they're just adorable. But then in talking with you guys, it was, hey, if you've got a spare pair of boots, and I actually left my boots down there, as well as bringing those pairs down. I think I got 6 or 8 pairs down there. And what really resonated with me about that idea was that's going to be bringing in the income for those families is to try to protect those feet. But I will tell you, those guides, some of them were literally walking on coral in bare feet, and it did not even faze them for a bit. So their feet are tough. That said, I think they really appreciate a good pair of boots. I have been told that whether you bring boots or a good pair of sunglasses, that you should not be offended if the guides don't wear them right away, especially because these are new items and these people are not at all accustomed to new stuff. They will wear stuff down till it's absolutely ruined and then maybe use it one more time before putting on that new pair of boots or really good condition boots or that new pair of shades. So I would think that what makes most sense is to bring that stuff until they say they don't need it.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, the other thing we can do is, you know, get that whole fly fishing economy restarted.
Yeah.
And I know there's a lot of people, we've got basically a 3-year backlog of trips that have had to be rolled over and rolled over again. So, things look bright for the foreseeable future. There are still some near future opportunities to book Christmas Island and get back there in the early months of reopening. But you know, keep that tap flowing as far as anglers and support for the angling industry over there. No doubt about it. That's great. Well, Tim, thanks so much for being here and sharing the details of your trip. This has been a great conversation, and I know our listeners appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Jim. And thanks to your staff. You guys do fantastic work.
We appreciate that. And that is it for this latest episode of Waypoints, the podcast that is 100% dedicated to travel and the search for adventure. Be sure to visit yellowdogflyfishing.com to plan and research your next fishing trip and stay up to date on the latest travel news and developments. You can also visit the Waypoints podcast archives for dozens of previous episodes that cover and explore the world of destination angling. Join us for our next episode of Waypoints, and remember, life is short and no one ever regretted a life of adventure.
This has been another episode of Waypoints, the podcast of fly fishing, travel, and adventure angling. Waypoints is produced by Brian Gregson with music provided by the Steep Canyon Rangers. Visit yellowdogflyfishing.com for more destination profiles, travel news, and expert advice, and be sure to join us for our next episode.